Genesis 24. Actually, let me put it this way. We are in Genesis 24, whether you got to it or not last week, because that's where I studied. So turn to Genesis 24. I'm going to read. We'll see how far I get. We're not going to do the whole chapter. It's actually the single longest narrative in Genesis. Now, I don't mean by the Joseph story takes, as you'll discover, several years to teach. No, it's quite long. It's the single longest one-piece story. Like, if you were watching it as a YouTube short, it would be the single longest bit of narrative in there. So we're not obviously going to cruise through that whole thing this morning. This morning, we're going to just look at the preparation for Isaac's marriage, in Genesis 24. So read along with me. Now, Abraham was old, advanced in age, and the Lord had blessed Abraham in every way. Abraham said to his servant, the oldest of his household, who had charge of all that he owned, "Please place your hand under my thigh, and I will make you swear by the Lord, the God of heaven and the God of earth, that you shall not take a wife for my son from the daughters of the Canaanites among whom I live, but you will go to my country and to my relatives and take a wife for my son Isaac." The servant said to him, "Suppose the woman is not willing to follow me to this land. Should I take your son back to the land from where you came?" Then Abraham said to him, "Beware that you do not take my son back there. The Lord, the God of heaven, who took me from my father's house and from the land of my birth, and who spoke to me and who swore to me, saying, 'To your descendants I will give this land,' he will send his angel before you, and you will take a wife for my son from there. But if the woman is not willing to follow you, then you will be free from this my oath. Only do not take my son back there." So the servant placed his hand under the thigh of Abraham, his master, and swore to him concerning this matter. Then the servant took 10 camels from the camels of his master and set out with a variety of good things of his master's in his hand. And he arose and went to Mesopotamia to the city of Nahor. He made the camels kneel down outside the city by the well of water at evening time, the time when women go out to draw water. He said, "O Lord, the God of my master Abraham, please grant me success today and show loving kindness to my master Abraham." Let's pray. Father, I thank you for your word. Thank you for the joy of studying it together. Lord, by the power of your Spirit, may you bring the clarity and the wisdom of your word home to our hearts today so that Christ might be glorified. We pray it in his name. Amen. So, as I said, we're going to look at the preparation for Isaac's marriage. And as we move through this, it's inevitable that we're going to talk quite a lot about marriage. Don't worry, I didn't switch places with Justin while we were gone. He still is Mr. Marriage Morgan to ministry. However, we're going to talk a lot about marriage. And one of the things I need to say before we start in this is that this is a conversation about marriage in which we have to be somewhat cautious, because as you know from Chris's famous illustration, there's many ways people got married in the Bible, very few of which are ways, are roadmaps for how we ought to get married, right? That's usually not going and killing 100 of your enemies and taking their foreskins back to your father. It's not usually a prescribed method of anything other than ending up in jail in our society. So there are biblical principles about marriage, and yet this is a passage which is not generally concerned with those principles for marriage. We're going to see some, and I think in a way we're going to see some of the things that will eventually become biblical principles for marriage in a sense prefigured here as we move forward. Really, the first examination of marriage, or at least the process of entering into marriage, after Genesis 2:24, which God arranged, right? So this is the first time that the Bible has looked at in depth a believing, if you will, or a faithful preparation for marriage. So we've seen bad ones before, but the first examination of entering into marriage for faithful people post Genesis 2:24, which just God did the arranging of the marriage and he said, this is what it is, and everything was perfect, right? So it's interesting because we're going to see that. So we're going to see some things that I think are wise about marriage. There's some wisdom here that we're going to see about entering into marriage from listening to an old Abraham and his old and faithful servant, right? They've been around, as the song that I sing to my kids often says, the Proverbs song, they've been around a couple years, they've seen a few things, and they have an idea of what marriage ought to be successful before the Lord, and we'll see some of that wisdom. So what I'm trying to get across to you is that there are principles here. But there are also many things that aren't to the level of, wow, you have to do this because this is the way that Abraham did it. But there's some wisdom that we can learn from. So in my job, there are things that we absolutely have to do. They're written in the book. You say them this way. You everything is absolutely verbatim. You're rolling down the runway. I say 80. He says 80. I mean, it's just like perfectly scripted out. There's no freedom to be like, but I think it would be better if I said this thing, right? But then there are plenty of things in my job that there are multiple ways to skin the cat, right? Like in anything. And anytime an instructor in our schoolhouse tells us, hey, this is a way that I like to do this thing, they all often say, this is technique, right? That's code for, I really think you should do this way, and it really makes a lot of sense, but I can't hold you to that, right? There's no principle to this. It just seems to make sense. So there's a lot about what we'll see about marriage this morning that is technique. And part of what's challenging about this passage is to try to register properly whether something is associated with the biblical principle towards marriage or if it's more a technique, more wisdom. In a sense, this is listening to two old men talk wisely about marriage, right? And I think it's a very helpful conversation, but we need to be able to have our ears open to the fact that not necessarily do you need to go ask your dad to send an old friend with 10 camels to find you a wife, right? Or the other way around, which would be even more interesting. If Jen had sent 10 camels for me, I'm pretty sure I could not have resisted that. So just saying. Anyway, so we're going to look at this preparation for marriage, and I can't help but think that as Abraham is, as we'll see here in a minute, old, blessed in every way, and considering how he moves on in a sense to glory, how he lives out the last few remaining years that he has on this earth, that his mind has moved to marriage not only for his son's sake, but because he has now been parted from his wife of many years, and maybe in a sense reflecting on the blessing that Sarah has been in his life. You have to think that having just laid his wife to rest after many years, many more years than most of us will ever be alive, and sure, we're familiar with the Hagar things and some of the more challenging things, and yet we know both biblically and just I think from the few glimpses of their marriage that we see, they experienced a highly successful marriage, right? They're his beloved companion of many years, someone who was, think about this, always all the way in on God's plan, right? Now, not always all the way in on how to get to executing that, right? Sometimes has some strange ideas, but think about this. This is a woman who never once in the pages of Scripture indicates, unlike Lot's wife, that she is uncomfortable with the fact that they've left everything she knows and gone out into the middle of nowhere, right? She's always been in line with God's plan. Sometimes struggled to believe that God would bring it about in the ways that even Abraham has struggled with, but someone who has been a dear and faithful companion to him. And so as he's thinking about, okay, God's plan is now moving into its next phase, and I'm not in it anymore, in a sense. I'm moving out of this. I'm moving out of the world and all of God's work in it. You have to think that he's thinking, I need to ensure that my son has such a companion by his side. So there's some urgency to this. Now, as we move into this, just look first briefly before we look at the actual preparation for Isaac's marriage here. Look at this precious description of Abraham in verse 1. I told, I think, Andrew last night, I'm not sure I'm ever going to get past verse 1. It says, Abraham was old, advanced in age, and the Lord had blessed Abraham in every way. What a beautiful description of someone, right? Not necessarily the old part. Everybody gets old unless they die young, right? That's just there. But to think about this, he's old, he's advanced in years, he's been around, he's seen the things, right? And then this corollary, the Lord had blessed him in every way. Abraham's whole life has been about the promise of blessing, right? And now at the end of his life, it's experienced. It's a promise experienced. He has seen the Lord's blessing in every way. I just think, what a beautiful expression of Christian or of faithful maturity. Beautiful thing to have seen. And I thought about it maybe because I've just been on this trip, thinking about it in this way. Most of our lives, particularly when you're younger and younger than me, most of our lives is an expectation of the Lord's work and blessing, right? And that's true always for Christians because we're never fully, the Lord hasn't returned yet, so our life will always be one of expectation. But think about, you do all this work, and I love to plan trips. I'm a nerd, I guess. I like to do logistics. It interests me to think about, you know, an hour between this flight and that flight ought to work out, whatever. But you do all this work, you think about how to do these things, and you do it with the expectation that it's going to be enjoyable generally, right? Right? Like, you don't go on a vacation thinking, well, this will probably be terrible, right? But you also don't know what it will be like. So you sometimes find out that your planning was not quite what you thought it would be, and you're like, this Motel 6 has roaches. This was not in my plan, right? Or you go on a trip and you're like, wow, this exceeded my expectations. I thought this was going to be really great. This exceeded my expectations. These Cheerios are really crunchy, right? You know, whatever it is. And you're like, wow, this is really good, right? And you know what that's like. You know the expectation of something. And then you know the joy, I think, of looking back at something that you had planned, hoped for, and experienced, and saying, oh, this exceeded my expectations. The Lord was very gracious in this thing. But it's a different perspective on the same thing, right? Before, you have in your mind what it might be like. Afterwards, you have the memory and the joy of remembering, hey, this is how this turned out. And it's a totally different way of looking at life, right? You look back at a successful trip or a wonderful trip differently than you look forward to one. And you all know what that's like. Abraham has done that in his faithful life. His life has been defined, as you'll see, as he himself describes it later, by the Lord swearing a promise to him, making this oath to him that is summed up in this word blessing. I will bless you and you will be a blessing to the earth. And now, at the end of his life, he has finished well, right? He is someone who is old, advanced in years, and he has been blessed by the Lord in every way. What a beautiful picture from someone we've got to walk through his long life together in a very short amount of time. And we have moved with him from what would that be like in the future to now where he is content in the land. He actually owns some of the land now. He's seen his son after many, many years of wondering, will I ever have a son? He's seen his son. He's grown. He has experienced the Lord's blessing in his life, and it's appropriate to say that he's experienced this. He has been blessed in every way. Of course, all of the Lord's blessings aren't done. And of course, his life is still looking in expectation. But I thought, what a beautiful picture of Christian maturity, that we would be people who can express to others the blessing that we have experienced of the Lord. And I thought of some of the older saints that I've known who've done this well. My grandmother died very well in the sense that she was so aware in her later years of how much grace the Lord had showed to her. Right, we have Jennifer and I have a mutual friend in Texas who's just gone to be with the Lord. Her name is Patty Morse, and she's one of our elders' wives. And she lived this consistent joy from the moment I met her all the way through difficult cancer and all these other things, where she just regularly communicated, the Lord has been good to me. And if you went to be by her side when she was very ill and in chemo and everything else, the thing that would not come out of her was the trouble she was in at the moment, or just the fact that she was old and nearing the end. What would come out of her, just reflexively come out of her, is the Lord is good. I have seen the Lord's goodness. I have been blessed by him in every way. Let me communicate to you what it's like to be a saint on the far end of these things, looking back at a life that the Lord has, I have seen the Lord manage to meet all of my expectations of his goodness in a far superabundant way, right? This is the Lord's faithfulness just oozed out of her, right? And she could say to you, the Lord has been good. I have been blessed in every way. I saw very briefly last week that as Johnny Erickson Tata spoke at the Sing Conference in Nashville a couple weeks ago, as she's become now quite old and in difficult health, as she finished that last message that she said there, she closed with, I'll see you on the other side. And I thought, what a precious thing for her to say after years of having lived a life where she's paralyzed, and most people would say, what can you do with your life at that point? For her to say, in every one of these years of my very difficult life, I have been blessed by the Lord in every way. Not in all the things that you might hope or expect that life might bring, but in all the things that he has promised to his people, and all the grace and the hope that you might have for true life. She says, I've been blessed in every way, and I'll see you on the other side. I even thought about this. I was reading Keith Getty's tribute to Queen Elizabeth II, in which he said that it's so rare in the Christian world, and this is sadly true, it's so rare in the Christian world to see leaders that finish well. They tend to burn and then disappear, and that's not always true by the Lord's grace. But it is rare to see someone who I trust was a believer, but you don't ever know. And she never granted an interview in her entire 96-year life, 96-year life, so that makes things a little challenging. But somebody who's so consistent and who's so recognized to say, hey, the Lord is good, the Lord is good, the Lord is good. What a blessing that is to know someone like Abraham who by the end of his life, we don't have to say, well, that was pretty good, but he was kind of right off in the end. That happens in the Bible, where you're like, wow, that was, okay. I mean, Noah is kind of that way, right? You're like, wow, he got through the flood, and then, man, did things kind of go downhill after there. And so Abraham here, he's been blessed in every way. And I would just say to you, you're very young. I'm hopefully very young, despite what Eva told me on the trip. Now she's awake. I asked how old our guide was, and everybody's like, oh, 40. And Eva's like, so, you know, fairly close to your age. And I was like, oh, thank you for that. Anyway, but I pray that as you have experienced the goodness of the Lord, that that would radiate back out of you. As you interact with our high school age people or your colleagues at work or your fellow students, and particularly the other people in the church, you are adults. This is a young adult ministry, but it is an adult ministry. You have experienced, I trust, the kindness of the Lord. Would that be the way that you speak, particularly to the younger people that you disciple and trust? Hey, I've walked through these difficult years that you're about to walk through or have walked through, in which it seems like, man, I don't know if I'm ever going to get on my own. I don't know how I'm going to handle all these decisions. I don't know how many more times do I have to take the SAT, 3,000 times or 6,000 times, you know, however many. And you could say, but you know what? And all of those things, I've been blessed by the Lord in every way. He is my rock. I have been hard on Abraham at points where I think the text is hard on Abraham, right? But this is the last narrative comment on Abraham. He's been blessed by the Lord in every way. What a beautiful picture. I told you I was going to struggle to get even past that because it's so precious to me. Be those people that when you encounter others, you say, you know what? In all of this, the Lord is good. It's not just a narrative comment on Abraham. It pervades the way Abraham thinks now. Abraham is one who is experienced in trusting the Lord's promises. And you'll see that maturity of mindset as he moves through thinking how to make sure that his son makes a good marriage. Now, another thing I'll say about making a good marriage here. Sometimes we act as if the making of the marriage is everything. It is very important. We'll see some principles. We'll see some conversation between two old wise men here about how to make a good marriage. We will also see from this same marriage between Isaac and Rebekah that to make a marriage is not enough. To maintain and mature one in a biblical way is critical because 10 years from now, their marriage is just in the pits, right? So I would say to you, the making of a good marriage is very important. When you say, I do, the effort and the labor does not go away, right? It increases. You must then work together to honor the Lord together, to mature that together. This is something that Abraham cannot control. So however you enter into marriage, for those of you who are sitting there this morning going, man, I sure wish somebody, Justin, in my life would come together and make this marriage between me and this person and provide the camels and life would go forward and everything would be wonderful, right? The making of a marriage matters. But whether that happens from somebody arranging it for you or whether it happens from you actually doing the work and getting a job, as Sam would like to say, there are principles for entering, but there are requirements that you make it move forward. We're only looking at one of them. The making of a marriage does not guarantee the success of a marriage. It's critical for establishing success, but it does not make a successful marriage. You must mature. You must move together forward in a way that you continue to honor the Lord. And that's something, unfortunately, we'll see that Isaac and Rebekah don't do. You can get an arranged marriage between two really old wise people who do all the things and think through it properly, but if the power of the Lord and the Spirit of the Lord and the humility of the people to move forward together isn't there, great, you cleared the first hurdle. It's a marathon. So that's all I'm saying here is it's a marathon. If you're like, yay, my dad arranged this, I can sit back and relax. Not happening. Also, I've met like two people in my entire life whose parents arranged their marriage, so don't get excited. It does happen. They were Indian, and it was super successful, and they met each other the day they got married. And you know how that worked? All the requirements at the beginning were there. They were both believers. They both loved the Lord. They both loved the church. And then they did the hard work of maintaining and maturing a marriage. But it's probably not going to happen to you. So there's an urgency now in Abraham's life as he's old and thinking about how he moves out of God's plan and that the next generation moves forward. And I was struck by this too. Sometimes when you're wondering like, man, why do I hear so much from Justin and Nathan and whatever else about marriage? I was reminded that my grandmother was so content when I when Jenna and I got married. She's like, I can die in peace now. And I was kind of like, okay. There's an urgency. As Chris likes to say, 99% of you will be married. There's an urgency on the part of those who love you, who are older and wiser and mature, not necessarily to see that you enter into marriage, but to see that you move forward in a way that is thriving and successful in the life of the church. Some of you will not be married. Some of you will be single all of your lives, just like Paul and Jesus, right? That's a good and godly thing. But there is a wise, right concern to say, we want to see you enter into this well, because this is very weighty, and it often does set the trajectory for your life. Abraham is very concerned about this because he wants to know that Isaac will be able to track along the line of the Lord's promises. And the most distracting, destructive thing towards tracking in line towards the Lord's promises is to enter into a marriage badly. Right? So if there's a lot of concern that you hear from us, if there's some urgency and angst that sometimes enter our voices, when my voice goes up 3 octaves when you said, hey, I'm dating this person, and I'm like, oh. Right? Or yay, okay. That's because the Bible is very clear. To enter into a marriage wisely is very, very important. There's nothing more that can distract or move a true believer away from running the path that the Lord has given than to enter into a marriage in a non-biblical way, right? That's why I'm saying the gate, the hurdle is high. Then you must run well in that hurdle, but the hurdle is high for a reason. And as we see principles here and developing principles, that's going to be the most important one we see. The way that you enter into this is very important. So Abraham says to his servant, the oldest of his household, who had charge of all that he had. Now, isn't this interesting? In two ways. When Abraham says, hey, my son needs a wife, he has basically 3 options of people he could call in this situation to help with the situation. Number one is Isaac. Isaac does not get a call for 2 reasons. The most important reason is because in this culture, sons don't make their own marriages. Right. That's 99% of the reason. In my mind, the other 1% is because young sons don't usually make good decisions on this without some wise counsel in the process. But mostly this is cultural. So Isaac is out of the picture. Who does he not send? He doesn't send Isaac Budd, right? He doesn't send, oh, hey, send 2 20-year-olds down the road, the guys that would make this trip really easily. Hey, I'm not going to pick 2 of my random young servants to go see if the girl is cute and bring her back, right? No, look at the urgency, look at the weight of whom he chooses. He chooses his oldest, wisest servant. Why? Because you need some old, wise person to set up your marriages. No, because he needs someone whose heart tracks along the same lines of established wisdom that his does, because these are serious things. And as we'll see all the way through this preparation, the Bible in this passage brings up all sorts of things that could be attractive about this person. Hey, Rebecca is beautiful. Oh, but actually that's not what he's tracking for, right? So he needs somebody involved in this conversation who can help him think wisely about it. Guys, that's a principle about marriage. You need people in your lives who can help you think wisely about it, and you need the oldest, most established in wisdom people you can get your hands on, right? Think about the sacrifice this is to Abraham and also to the servant who's like, I don't want to take my wheelchair across the floor, right? You know, right? Who does he pick? He picks his right-hand man. What do you need right-hand men for? To keep your house running, to keep everything working, right? Like, I mean, you saw what I was like while Andrew Williams was in India. I'm just like, the whole ministry is falling apart, right? Where's my right hand? And you need your right-hand men. They're established and wise. I mean, Jared doesn't show up This looks like a coffee shop. It is a coffee shop, but it does, you know, right? He's sending all of that away. He's sending him on a long road trip. He's going to wake up the next morning and be like, where's my coffee? Where's my coffee? Oh, my servant is gone, right? Like he is making a substantial investment in this because there's a critical and important thing in preparing for marriage, and that is you need wisdom at your side when you're doing this. Again, I said this is a conversation about marriage where I'm trying very hard not to principalize everything in this text because they're not all principles. It's a conversation about wisdom into entering into marriage, and Abraham's go-to is let me pick the wisest, most trustworthy person, and we'll see what in his mind makes this guy wise and trustworthy as we move forward. By the way, in my mind, the hero of this story is the servant, right? He is never named. We think it's probably Eliezer of Damascus because it's who he mentions earlier is probably going to be his heir, right? He's never named, though, because the Bible's making a point. What stands out about this guy is how much his heart resonates with Abraham's own wisdom and own mindset on things. So Abraham says, hey, my right-hand man, come talk with me. I'm going to give you a charge. I'm going to have you swear an oath. I wonder where Abraham got the idea of swearing oaths from. I don't know. God, I don't know. Anyway, right? I'm going to charge you very urgently that you would do something. Why this charge? A, because he's essentially establishing the authority for this guy to go be his mouthpiece on the other side of the planet. But also, I think in Abraham's mind, perhaps I will die before he comes back. This could be a long process. I don't know. You know, the funny thing is we know the end of the story. We know it's like boom, 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 right? But Abraham doesn't know how hard, and we'll see here in a minute. He's aware of the challenge of finding the right spouse. So I think Abraham is saying, hey, in case, by the way, biblical characters are always like, I think I'm about to die, and then they live another 20 years, right? Lest we be too hard on them, people randomly die for all sorts of reasons in the ancient Near East. So he's got a reason. But I think he's saying, this is so important to me that I want this mission to outlast me. Right? You're essentially the marriage guardian for my son in case this outlasts me. And he has him swear this oath, put your hand under my thigh that I may make you swear by the Lord. Don't try this at home, okay? I looked through our seminary's journals for, you know, like 5 hours this week on why the put your hand under the thigh. Nobody has any reason. Nobody can tell you what anybody's thinking here. Don't try it at home. Just shake on it, right? It's okay. It's a cultural thing. But it's a very serious thing, right? It's the most serious way Abraham can come up with, this matters. I'm placing all my trust and vulnerability in your hands. I might be about to die. You need to protect my son in this. What's the charge? That you will not take a wife for my son from the daughters of the Canaanites among whom I dwell, but will go to my country and to my kindred and take a wife for my son Isaac. Now, lest you just think, well, that's racist, or man, he must not like the people whom he dwells among. Remember, Abraham's line is blessed by the Lord, right? This is the fallout of Noah and Shem, Ham, and Japheth and Noah's sin. Abraham's line is blessed by the Lord in two ways. He's a Shemite, and he's been called out, as we'll see through this passage. He's been brought out from his family and sent out by the Lord. But more importantly, the Canaanites are directly cursed, right? They're directly cursed by the Lord in the same passage. So he's not just saying, I think they smell funny and I don't like them. He's saying they're outside of God's plan for his people at this point. And more importantly, he has firsthand experience of what they're like. And he's saying, I don't need that godlessness for my son. So this is a spiritual concern, not a racial or cultural concern. This is a concern that he tracked with God's plan for these people. And this is the beginning. I said this is the first time we've seen post-fall a discussion of how you enter into marriage wisely. This is the beginnings of a biblical principle. Because as you trace this all the way through the Bible, the command always to the Israelites is marry faithful people, don't marry those outside of God's plan. And that comes down to us finally at this point, you may not be, listen to the words I use there, you may not be unequally yoked. You must marry a believing person. You must marry, for the terms of talking about this in the Old Testament, a faithful person. This is the beginnings of what is inevitably a biblical principle all the way down to this very direct command from Paul, you must do this thing, right? This is the most important thing. You may not derail God's intention for your life by being yoked with someone, by being one flesh with someone who is a dead person, right? Someone whose heart and life and in every way is tracking away from you. Guys, this is so important. I know that I have 15 minutes left. That's fine. We're going to get where we're going. I have to belabor this because it is so important. This does not mean evangelism dating, right? He does not say, so go ask the Canaanite around the road and say, are you cool with this? No, you can't go there, right? You must reserve and guard your heart and your entry into marriage for someone who has established and demonstrated the cost of being committed to God's plans in the world, right? You must do that. What does that mean? Most of the time it means you're going to have to see somebody who's committed to the life of the local church. You're just going to have to do it, right? You're going to have to find someone whose life is already that way so that you know that it wasn't you that made them say those things. Guys, I speak about this both from the biblical perspective, but also from my own life. My mother was a solid, strong, believing woman who thought my dad was cute. My dad's not a believer. And it literally, I'm glad up for it, obviously, but it literally destroyed her life. Right? She married him. He said, oh, I'll be a believer, whatever else. He left her 2 years later, and on he went, right? And part of the reason he left her is because he couldn't stay in that marriage where she is saying, but I have to be faithful to the Lord. That's his choice to leave, but still. These things happen. You are vulnerable to this. This is why there's two elements here, wisdom and then beginning a marriage with the right person. You must only look to someone who has a track record, whose commitment is proven to be, these are the Lord's people, these are people that are tracking with the Lord's promises and plan, and not someone else. You will destroy your life. You must not let your heart guide you. Wisdom must guide you. I know that's strong, but the Bible is very strong about that. Jesus does not say, if he's cute, you may be unequally yoked. You may not be. The first church discipline case I ever encountered at Countryside Bible Church was over this issue. Someone, and maybe the second, they said, yeah, I know he's Mormon, but I'm going to marry him anyway. I was so grateful to that church to say, you cannot confuse the clarity of the gospel, and you cannot reject the Lord's direct command in this way. Go to my country, to my kindred, take a wife for my son Isaac. Now, this is why it's so wonderful to have good, godly, wise friends who can speak to you in your life. I love this servant. He's so cool. Because Abraham, and you know, at this point I'm being very nice to Abraham. I'm not complaining about Abraham, right? I'm not trying to take away from that. I'm just saying this is how this works when you have good, wise, godly friends. Abraham says, you know, we're charging this way. Here's my charge for you. Swear to this. And his friend says, may I ask a question? The servant says, in all that speech you just made that sounded really great, and my heart is with you, Abraham, but since I'm the one who's getting on the camel and going a long way for this, can I ask a question about this that you might not have thought through? What if she doesn't want to move here? Reasonable, right? Hey, come marry some guy. Now, by the way, I don't know if you noticed this in chapter 23. He has communicated with his family back in Paddan Aram, right? Somehow somebody comes and brings him the mail and says, hey, they've had kids and we've had kids. You know, so there's some sort of group Facebook going on here. And some way or another, they're at least aware that they're still alive. But, you know, profile picture not included. How are you going to convince this, you know, this girl, hey, come marry a stranger who's living in the desert, right? I mean, not exactly a real huge inducement to, you know, say, she's like, well, why don't he come here, right? I like my house. I like my life. I'll marry him, but I have no desire to move out into the desert where all these Canaanites are and hope that he has more than a few tents to his name, right? It's not necessarily a great proposal. So Abraham's like, take my wife, my son's wife from my relatives. And he goes, okay, but what if she don't want to move here? What if she's like, yeah, that's fine, but he has to move here. What about that, Abraham? Isn't that wonderful? I just was struck by this week. To have, and Abraham doesn't go, you idiot. Abraham's like, ah, good point, right? It's so wonderful to cultivate relationships. And look, this guy's his servant. It's a servant-boss relationship. To know that Abraham has cultivated an atmosphere of wisdom in his household where his wise old servant can say to him, Abraham, what about this issue of your plan? Have those people. That's not a huge point in the sermon, but it is wonderful. Have those people around you who will say, in the middle of your speech, did you consider the glaring error in your potential loophole in your thinking? What about this? Can I take him back there if she won't come here? Abraham goes, no. So Abraham said to him, see to it that you do not take my son back there. By the way, he doesn't say, you idiot. He just says, no. Okay, good. Thank you for the clarification. Here's a further clarification to what I just swore you to. See that you don't take him back there. That is not where the plan of God is tracking. And then listen to this brief description of Abraham's own life. The Lord
the God of heaven who took me from my father's house and from the land of my kindred, who spoke to me and swore to me. I love this. He took, he spoke, and he swore to me. That is Abraham's life in a nutshell. I have been brought out from where I was. The Lord has made himself known to me. He's revealed himself to me, and he has promised to me these blessings, right? What a beautiful description of our own lives too, right? The Lord took you from where you were. He made himself known to you, and he has promised his blessings to you in Christ, right? If you are in Christ, this is a brief description of your own life, but I love how he describes it. Like, and this is the grounding for all that Abraham will tell him what to do. How does he know, for example, oh goodness, maybe I can put this test to this girl out here and the Lord will supernaturally intervene, right? This is the reason, this is the theological reasoning for Abraham's oath-giving instruction here. My life has been characterized by this. I've been taken from a group of people. Yes, I want my son from that group of people because they're like the best possible choice of people who are going to track with God's things. But I have been taken out of that, from my father's house, from the land I grew up. The Lord has made himself known to me, and he has set up a plan. He has directed me towards his business and his plan, and my son is part of that. He needs to stay tracking with that, so she's got to come here. She's got to be willing to be part of that. We're not going back in time. We're not going the other way. And he reiterates the promise. He will send his angel before you, and you shall take a wife for my son from there. Now, how does Abraham know that? Don't know. Doesn't say. Either God spoke to Abraham about this and said, I will provide providential, supernatural aid for your servant, in which case you would think that the servant's like, and you didn't mention that before, because why? And that's pretty helpful. Or, and I think much more likely, this is the mature, blessing-experienced Abraham's chain of thinking. I don't know how the Lord will bring things to pass, but I do know he will invariably bring them to pass because he has committed himself to this train of thinking. What a beautiful change in Abraham, right? This is the established, mature, wise Abraham who has been through now, working through his son being offered up and all these other things. This is not the Abraham who says, hey, I know, let's go with the Hagar plan. Hey, I know, let's pretend you're my sister again, right? This is an Abraham who says, I know the Lord has promised these things. I don't know how it's going to work out, but I guarantee you he will providentially provide. It's a beautiful picture. There's a confidence, and I'm not sure how this is going to work out, but the Lord is going to adhere to his plans and his principles, and we just need to get in line with that as best as we can plan and do. But Abraham is so wise here. Verse 8. But if the woman is not willing to follow you, then you will be free from this, my oath. Right? This is the mature Abraham again. He says, I'm confident the Lord's plan is good. It seems best to me, there's my favorite word from Chris, right? Seems best to me that you choose a wife who will be on board with that plan from this location in this way. I'm confident in the Lord's provision that he will invariably continue his promise to Isaac that he will be a fruitful nation. Gonna have to have a wife. But if this, my great plan, this, my solemn concern for my son, is not the way the Lord intends to fulfill this, then I release you from this oath. I trust the Lord fully. I've made a wise plan, and we'll see where the Lord goes with it. That's just like, oh, Abraham, my heart is resonating with you. It's so beautiful in his planning. And what a wonderful way for our own planning. Make wonderful, good plans. Fill your camels up. Get on the road. Say, if the Lord's not willing to provide the right person, if the Lord's not willing to provide the right opportunity that lets me track with the established promises and principles in my life, then the Lord will surely bless me in the right ways. And I don't know where that's going to come, but I just think it's beautiful. By the way, this establishes the key criteria for this woman. What must she be like? She must be willing to be a mini Abraham. Right? She must be willing to step away in faith from her established, comfortable life and trust that God's promises and blessing to Abraham will be his promises and blessing to her so that she is on board with God's promise. Right? She has to say, I will be taken from my family and from my home. I will trust this God and I will believe in his promises, not to herself, but to Abraham and to Isaac, that she would be part of it. She has to be willing to say, yeah, that God is my God. That promise is my promise. I'm going to stake my life on a promise made to someone else, right? Which I think is amazing. This is the critical This verse establishes her critical character. What must this woman be like? She must be willing to go. She must be willing to depart. We'll see that. Remember that for next week. We'll see that as it comes through the servant's wise planning. So the servant put his hand under the thigh of Abraham, his master, swore to him concerning this matter. Then the servant took 10 of his master's camels and departed, taking all sorts of choice gifts from his master, and he arose and went to Mesopotamia, to the city of Nahor. I love this. Now the servant knows what his mission is, and he then says, okay, Abraham doesn't have to tell him, oh, do this, this, and this, and this, and this. He says, I know how to put this principle into a plan with camels involved. Right? He knows, he's like, I know how to move forward on this. He's made the right provision. I need 10 camels. You're like, why 10 camels? Hey, good. Look, she's going to have to bring some stuff back with her. Why 10 camels? I was just out in the middle of nowhere in Africa this week, and I became very aware of how dangerous the road can be. And you don't show up and say, hey, like to marry your daughter off to my master's son, and she gets to hike back to Mesopotamia. No, he's gonna bring all that's necessary to communicate God's blessing to his master in physical, tangible terms to these people. And Abraham doesn't have to tell him how to do it. He just knows. He's got the wisdom and the know-how to be like, I can put this plan into action. And he loads these camels up with representative pictures of God's blessing to Abraham in every way. He takes all the good stuff. He takes basically the Costco sample set of all of Abraham's good stuff with him on the camel, so it can be like, and this is on offer, and this is on offer, and this is on offer. So he's got all the wisdom for that. We don't want to talk about that next week, which is why I'm just mentioning this really quick. And then he goes to the right place at the right time. This is where we're going to finish, because I got 1 minute left. But this is a borderline wise principle. I don't know if it's quite a principle, but look at where he goes. He shows up, and he goes to the well in the evening. Why do you go to the well in the evening? Because it's really hot in the middle of the day. Nobody wants to do anything in the middle of the day. We just ran into that while we were in Africa too, in the morning. They do all the stuff in the morning, and then you literally do zip but sit by the pool for 4 hours, and then okay, it's time to be busy again, right? So he goes to the well at the evening because who's there? All the young ladies. All the young ladies? No, probably not all of the young ladies, right? It's the first step of his thinking carefully about this. She's a rich girl. I don't think all the rich girls go hauling their own house's water out of the well. Only the right sort do, right? But it is nonetheless the right place to go to find the young ladies or the young men. And I'm going to just close with this. It's not a principle, but it's wisdom. Go to the well, right? If you're sitting in your living room or you're sitting in Starbucks on Instagram and you're like, just don't ever seem to meet anybody who's tracking along with the prince. It just seems to be marriage material. Where are you? Think about where you're at. If you want to marry somebody who's going to be the right sort of person to flourish in God's plan and purposes, be here. Be doing solid things for the kingdom and the glory of God, right? Be growing and maturing in that. You've heard what Chris has said about trajectory before. This guy is trajectory fishing. He's looking for the right, rich young lady who's actually out doing work, who can actually go live in the desert with his master, right? He's saying, where am I going to find somebody whose character is on display in the right places? Right? If he goes and sits in the desert 400 miles away, he ain't going to find her. Or you're not going to find him. Guys, it's not a principle. It's just wisdom. You go to the places and you get involved with and passionate about the things the Lord is passionate and involved with. And guess who you generally tend to meet in those places? People who love the Lord are passionately involved in it. Does that mean if you show up at church next week, Justin's going to find somebody for you to marry? Probably, but maybe you shouldn't. I don't know, right? This is being recorded, so I should probably be careful. If you're at Legoland, it's not happening. You're going to meet somebody who's passionate about what? I don't know, Legos. I'm picking on Legos. I love Legos, right? If you're at the makeup store, I don't know. I'm going to get in so much trouble by coming up with these illustrations. If you're somewhere other than here, right? Just so I don't offend anybody. If you're somewhere other than here, if you're somewhere other than in being involved in godly adult trajectories that honor and please the Lord, it's really hard to find somebody whose heart isn't to honor and please the Lord. It's possible. It's just very unlikely, right? So be at the well, right? That's not a principle. It's just wisdom. Be at the well. This is an old wise servant. He goes right to the right place. He doesn't stop at GameStop on the way, right? oh, I wonder if she's there. No, he goes to the right place first. I'm just saying. Now, if you do all of that, do you necessarily find somebody who goes, nice camels? No. But it's a start, right? Now that I'm in very deep trouble, let me pray. Father, I do thank you for your word. Lord, may we too be wise as this servant to consider how do we take your wisdom, your promises, your plans, and put them into practice in a way that is confident in you. Lord, I'm so struck that by the very first thing he does is he prays. With all of his planning and all of his things, he prays. Lord, may my heart and our hearts together be like this servant, to plan, to consider wisely, and then to pray, Lord, grant us success in honoring you. Lord, we pray that prayer for us this morning. Grant us success in growing from the truth of your word taught in church. Grant us your success in loving and caring for one another well in this group. Grant this church your success in being a gospel light in our world. We pray it for Christ's glory and in his name. Amen.